Chapter 6. Dominant among the ancient races, we can observe four: the Imas, the Jaghut, the Kachin Chimal, and the Fokral Asail. While others were present in the Eldritch times, either their numbers were scant or their legacies have all but vanished from the world. As for us humans, we were the rats in the walls and crawl spaces, those few of us that existed. But is not domination our birthright? Are we not the likenesses of carved idols and prophets? Do these idols not serve us? Do these prophets not prophesy our dominion over all other creatures? Perhaps you might note, with a sly wink, that the hands that carved the idols were our own, and that those blessed prophets so bold in their claims of righteous glory each emerged from the common human press. You might note, then, that our fierce assertions cannot help but be blatantly self-serving, indeed self-justifying. And if you did, well, you are no friend of ours. And for you we have this dagger, this pyre, this iron tongue of torture. Retract your claims to our unexceptional selves, our gross banality of the profane. As a species, we are displeased by notions of a mundane disconnect from destiny, and we shall hold to our deadly displeasure until we humans have crumbled to ash and dust. For, as the elder races would tell you, were they around to do so, the world has its own dagger, its own iron tongue, its own pyre, and from its flames there is nowhere to hide. Fragment purportedly from a translator's note to a lost edition of Gothos Folly, Genabaris, 835, Burns Sleep. 3 days and two nights they had stood among the dead bodies, the blood and gore dried on their tattered furs, their weapons. Their only motion came from the wind plucking at strands of hair and rawhide strips. The carrion birds, lizards, and cape moths that descended upon the field of slaughter fed undisturbed, leisurely in their feasting on rotting flesh. The figures standing motionless in their midst were too desiccated for their attentions. They might as well have been the stumps of long-dead trees, wind-torn and lifeless. The small creatures were entirely unaware of the silent howls erupting from the souls of the slayers, the unending waves of grief that battered at these withered apparitions, the horror churning beneath layers of blackened, dried blood. They could not feel the storm raging behind skin-stretched faces, in the caverns of skulls, in the shrunken pits of eye sockets. With the sun fleeing beneath the horizon on the third night, first sword Onos Tulan faced southeast, and with heavy but even strides set out, the sword in his hand dragging a path through the knotted grasses. The others followed, an army of destitute, bereft Tlani Mas, their souls utterly destroyed.
Slayers of the innocent, murderers of children. The stone weapons lifted and the stone weapons fell. Faces wrote knotted tales of horror. Small skulls cracked open like ostrich eggs. Spirits fled like tiny birds.
When the others left, two remained behind. Kaltur Manal of the Orshain Tlani Mas ignored the command of his clan, the pressure of its will. Trembling, he held himself against the sweep of that dread tide pulling so insistently into the first sword's shadow. He would not bow to Onos Tulan, and much as he yearned to fall to insensate dust, releasing forever his tortured spirit, instead he held his place, surrounded by half-devoured corpses, eye sockets plucked clean, soft lips and cheeks stripped away by eager beaks, and grasped in both hands the crumbling madness of all that life and death had delivered to him. But he knew with desolation as abject as anything he had felt before that there would be no gift of peace, not for him nor for any of the others, and that even dissolution might prove unequal to the task of cleansing his soul. The flint sword in his hand was heavy, as if caked in mud. If only it was. His bones, hardened to stone, wrapped round him like a cage of vast, crushing weight. As dawn rose on the fourth day, as the screams in his skull broke like sand before the wind, he lifted his head and looked across to the one other who had not yielded to the first sword's ineffable summons. A bonecaster of the Brold clan, of the second ritual, the failed ritual. And if only it had failed. Knife Drip, such a sweet name, such a prophetic name. This, said Kaltur Manal, is the ritual you sought, Nom Kala. This is the escape you desired. He gestured with his free hand. Your escape from these children, who would, in years to come, years they no longer have awaiting them, who would then have hunted down your kin, your mate, your children. They would have killed you all without a moment's thought. In their eyes, you were beasts. You were less than they were, and so you deserved less.
The beast, she said, that dies at the hand of a human remains innocent.
While that human cannot make the same claim.
Can they not?
Kaltur Manal tilted his head, studied the white fur-clad woman. The hunter finds justification.
Need suffices.
And the murderer?
Need suffices.
Then we are all cursed to commit endless crimes, and this is our eternal fate. And it is our gift to justify all that we do. But this is no gift. Tell me, Nom Kala, do you feel innocent?
I feel nothing.
I do not believe you.
I feel nothing because there is nothing left.
Very well. Now I believe you, Nom Kala.
He scanned the field of slaughter.
It was my thought to stand here until their very bones vanished beneath the thin soil, hid inside brush and grasses, until nothing remained of what has happened here.
He paused and then said again,
It was my thought.
You will find no penance, Kaltur Manal.
Ah, yes, that was the word I thought. I had forgotten it.
As you would.
As I would.
Neither spoke again until the sun had once more vanished, yielding the sky to the jade strangers and the broken moon that was rising fitfully in the northeast. Then Kaltur Manal hefted his weapon.
I smell blood.
Nom Kala stirred.
Yes, she said.
Immortal blood, not yet spilled, but soon.
Yes.
In moments of murder, said Kaltur Manal, the world laughs.
Your thoughts are harsh, replied Nom Kala,
settling her hair-matted mace in its sling draped across her back. She collected her harpoons.
Are they? Nom Kala, have you ever known a world at peace? I know the answer. I have existed far longer than you, and in that time there was no peace, ever.
I have known moments of peace, she said, facing him. It is foolish to expect more than that, Kaltur Manal.
Do you seek such a moment now?
She hesitated and then said,
Perhaps.
Then I shall accompany you. We shall journey to find it, that single most precious moment.
Do not cling to hope.
No, I shall cling to you, Nom Kala.
She flinched.
Do not do that, she whispered.
I can see you were beautiful once, and now, for the yearning in your empty heart, you are beautiful again.
Will you so torment me? If so, do not journey with me, I beg you.
I shall be silent at your side.
unless you choose otherwise, Nomkala. Look at us. We too remain deathless, and so well suited to this search for a moment of peace. Shall we begin?
Saying nothing, she began walking, as did he.
Do you remember how those flowers danced in the wind? Three women knelt in soft clays beside the stream, taking cupped handfuls of clear water to sprinkle upon the softened pranag hides before binding them. The migrations were underway, velvet upon the antlers, and the insects spun in iridescent clouds, flitting like delicious thoughts. The sun was warm that day. Do you remember? Greasy stones were lifted from the sacks, rolled in hands around the circle of laughing youths, while the cooked meat was drawn forth and everyone gathered to feast. It was, with these gentle scenes, a day like any other. The call from the edge of camp was not unduly alarming. Three strangers approaching from the south. One of the other clans, familiar faces, smiles to greet kin. The second shout froze everyone. I went out with the others. I held my finest spear in my hand, and with my warriors all about me, I felt sure and bold. Those who drew near were not kin, true strangers. If necessary, we would drive them off. There was this moment, please, you must remember with me. We stood in a row as they came to within 6 paces of us, and we looked into their faces. We saw ourselves, yet not. Subtle, the alterations. They were taller, thinner boned, strewn with fetishes and shells and beads of amber. Their faces did not possess the rounded comfort of Imas faces. Features had sharpened, narrowed. The bones of their jaw beneath the mouth jutted under dark beards. We saw their weapons and they confused us. We saw the fineness of their skins and furs and leggings, and we felt diminished. Their eyes were arrogant, the color of earth, not sky. With gestures, these three sought to drive us away. This was their land to hunt now. We were the intruders. Do you remember how that felt? I looked into their faces, into their eyes, and I saw the truth. To these tall strangers, we were Ranag, we were Bedarin, we were Pranag. Killing them made no difference, and the blood on our weapons weakened us with horror. Please, I am begging you, remember this. It was the day the world began to die. Our world. Tell me what you remember, you who stood facing these roughened savages with their blunt faces, their squat selves, their hair of red and blonde. Tell me what you felt, your indignation when we did not cower, your outrage when we cut you down. You knew you would come again, in numbers beyond imagining. And you would hunt us, chase us down, drive us into cold valleys and cliff caves above crashing seas, until we were all gone. And then, of course, you would turn on each other. If you dare to remember this, then you will understand. I am the slayer of children. Your children. No, show me no horror. Your hands are red with the blood of my children. You cannot kill us any more, but we can kill you, and so we shall. We are the sword of ancient memories. Memories of fire, memories of ice, memories of the pain you delivered upon us. I shall answer your crime. I shall be the hand of your utter annihilation, every last child. I am Onos Tulan, And once I was an Imas. Once I looked upon flowers dancing in the wind. See my army? It has come to kill you. Seek out the cold valleys. Seek out the caves and the cliffs over crashing seas. It will not matter. As these shelters failed us, so they will fail you. I see well this truth. You never expected our return. Too bad.
Yes, he would have liked these thoughts, this blistering, righteous pronouncement that vengeance was deserved and so meted out, and that the innocence of the young was a lie when they become the inheritors, when they grow fat on the evil deeds of their ancestors. They were, he knew, the thoughts of Olar Ithil, whispered into the secret places of his soul. He well understood her. He always had. The Bargast deserved their fate. They had slain his wife, his children, and he remembered the arrogance in the eyes of his family's slayers. But how had he seen that? It was impossible. He'd already been dead.
She creeps inside me. Olar Ithil, you are not welcome. You want me to serve you. You want... Yes, I know what you want, and you dare to call it healing. There is a dead seedling in you, Bonecaster. A shrunken, lifeless thing. In others, it lives on, sometimes frail and starving, sometimes thriving with sweet anguish. That seedling, Olar Ithil, has a name. And even the name would twist sour upon your lips. The name is compassion. One day I will stand before you, and I will kiss you, Olar Ithil, and give you a taste of what you never possessed. And I will see you choke, spit in bitter fury. And even then, to show you its meaning, I will weep for you. We have fled from it for too long. Our people are blessed, doomed people. Can you not shed a tear for them, Bonecaster, your putative children? They lived well in their slow failing, well enough. Show me the scene I never saw, the moment I never knew, when I stood before the first humans. Tell me of the blood I spilled. To echo my latest crime, to fuse the two together as if righteousness was a mask to be worn again and again. Do you think me a fool? Tok, my brother, sent me away. But I think now he was compelled. I think now, Olar Ithil, you held him fast. I have lost a brother, and I know he will never return. For his fate, I would weep, if I only could.
Forces were gathering to a place in the east. The ancient warren of Telan was a thing of raging fire, like the plains lit in flames on every horizon. He could feel the heat, could taste the bitter smoke. Elsewhere, not far, Omtos Phalak, churned awake with the thunder of riven ice. Seas cracked and valleys groaned, and closer to hand the stench of the Kachane Chemal rode the winds pungent as a serpent's belly. And now,
yes, Akrast Corvalain, the pale ghosts of old once more walk the land. The Elder Warrens rise again. By all the spirits of earth and water, what has begun here? Olar Ithil, in what comes, the Tlanimas shall be as motes of dust in a maelstrom. And what you seek, no, the price is too high. It is too high.
Yet he marched, as if destiny still existed for his people, as if death itself was no barrier to the glory awaiting them.
We have lost our minds. Talk younger. What is this winter tide that so carries us forward? Ride to me. Let us speak again, as we did once. Talk younger, I forgive you. For the wounds you delivered, for all that you denied me, I cannot but forgive you.
One last journey into the storm, then. He would lead. His lost kin would follow. He understood that much. Less than dust motes they might be, but the Talani Mas would be there.
We shall not be forgotten. We deserve better than that. We were you before you were born. Do not forget us. And in your memory, I beg of you, let us stand tall and proud. Leave to us our footprints in the sand, there to mark the trail you now tread, so that you understand, wherever you go, we were there first.
In the wake of Onos Tulan, 3,000 Tlani Mas followed. Orshane, Brold, and a score more forgotten clans, those that fell in the wars, those that surrendered to despair. It was likely, Ristal Ev suspected, that Onos Tulan was unaware that he had opened his mind to them, that the terrible emotions warring in his soul rushed out to engulf them all. The ancient barriers had been torn down, and she and all the others weathered the storm in silence, wretched, beaten into numbness. At the field of slaughter, his howls had echoed their own, but now the first sword was binding them in grisly chains. They would stand with him, they had no choice, and when at last he fell, as he must, so too would they. This was acceptable. It was, in fact, just.
Slayers of children deserve no glory. The caves are emptied now, but we cannot dwell there. The air is thick with the blood we spilled. Even the flames from the hearth cannot warm us.
She sensed that Kalt Urmanal was no longer with them. She was not surprised, and although her own anguish at his absence clawed at her, the pain felt distant, drowned beneath the torments of the first sword. Her love had always been a lost thing, and he had ever been blind to it. All the jealousy she had once felt lingered, a poison suffusing her being, tainting her love for him. He had been broken by the Kachain Chemal long ago, when they had slain his wife and children. Her love was for a memory, and the memory was flawed.
No, it is best that he is gone, that he decided he could not go on. The truth is, I admire the strength of his will, that he could so defy the first sword's power.
Had others remained behind? She did not know, but if they had, she prayed their presence would comfort Kalt Urmanal.
What is it to lose a love you never had?
Ulag Togtil, who had come among the Orshane Imas as a stranger, whose blood was thickened with that of the Trelan Telekai, now reeled in the first sword's wake, as if his limbs were under siege. There was a harshness to the Trelan that had stood him well on the day of the slaughter, but now it floundered in the depthless well that was the emotional torrent of the Imas.
To feel too deeply. Oh, how the callous would mock this. Their regard flat and gauging as a vulture's upon a dying man. Something to amuse, but even trees will tremble to cold winds. Are you so bereft, friend, that you dare not do the same? Onos Tulan gives us his pain. He is unaware of the gift, yet gift it is. We obeyed the command of the first sword, knowing nothing of his soul. We thought we had found in him a tyrant to beggar the Jaghut themselves. Instead, he was lost as we are. But if there be unseen witnesses to this moment, if there be callous ones among them, ah, what is it that you fear to reveal? There in that tear, that low sob, you smile in superiority. But what is the nature of this triumph of yours? I wish to know. Your self-made chains draped so tight about you are nothing to be proud of. Your inability to feel is not a virtue. And your smile has cracks.
Ulag had played this game all his life, and now he did so again in the ashes of Telan, in the swirling mad river of the First Sword's path, imagining his invisible audience a sea of blurred faces, a host of unknown thoughts behind the veil of their eyes. And he would speak to them from time to time.
I am the wolf that would die of loneliness if cast from the pack. And so, even when I am alone, I choose to believe otherwise. There was no true unity in the T'lani Mas, for we had surrendered the memories of our lives. Yet even then I refused to be alone. Ah, I am a fool. My audience belongs to future's judgment, and harsh it shall be. And when at last it speaks in that multitude of voices, I shall not be there to hear it. Can you be at ease with that, Ulag? Can you hear the dry laughter of the Trelan, the jeering of humans? But see how it bows you even now. See how it batters you down. Against the future, Ulag, you are helpless as a babe lying on a rock. And the eagle's shadow slides across the tear-filled eyes, the soft face. The babe falls silent, knowing danger is near. But alas, it has not even learned to crawl, and mother's hands are long gone. For this fate, Onos Tulan, we would all weep, if we could.
Shield Anvil Stormy picked himself up off the ground, blinking water from his eyes and probing his split cheek.
All right, he said, spitting blood. I suppose I deserved that. At least, and he glared at Gessler, that's what you're going to tell me right now. It is, isn't it? Tell me it is, or so help me, Guess, I'm going to rip your head right off and throw it in the nearest cesspit I find.
I needed to get your attention, the mortal sword replied. With you, subtle don't work.
How would you know? You ain't tried it yet. Not once in all the years I've been cursed by your company.
Well, said Gessler, squinting at the mass of Chimal Furies thumping past, turns out I got a solution for that. An end to your curse.
You can't run away. You can't leave me here.
No, it's you I'm sending away, Stormy.
What?
I'm the mortal sword. I can do things like that.
Send me where?
To her, to what's left of her.
Stormy looked away, south across the empty, dismal plain. He spat again.
You really don't like me much, do you?
We have to find out, Stormy. I could go myself, but you're the Shield Anvil. There will be the souls of friends hanging around like a bad smell. Will you just leave the ghosts to wander, Stormy?
What am I supposed to do with them?
How should I know? Bless them, I suppose, or whatever it is you have to do.
Destriant Callis was riding back to where they'd dismounted. She was looking at each of them in turn, back and forth, frowning at the red welt and split cheek under Stormy's left eye. She drew up her Vergath mount.
Don't you two ever just talk? Spirits below, men are all the same. What has happened?
Nothing, Stormy replied. I have to leave.
Leave?
It's temporary, said Gessler, swinging himself back into the bone and scale saddle that was his mount's back. Like a mangy pup, he'll show up again before too long.
Where is he going?
Callis demanded.
Back to where we came from, Gessler replied. Back to the bone hunters. They got hurt bad. We need to find out how bad.
Why?
Stormy glared up at Gessler, waiting for the bastard to come up with an answer to that question. But the mortal sword simply growled under his breath and kicked his charger into motion. As he rode away, Callis fixed her attention on Stormy.
Well?
He shrugged.
When there's trouble ahead, Destriant, it's good to know how your allies are faring.
His reply clearly disturbed her, though she seemed unable to explain why.
You will need an escort.
No, I won't.
Yes, you will, Shield Anvil. Your Vagath needs to eat. I will have Sag-Turok assign 3 Kel Hunters to you, and 2 drones. When do you leave?
He walked to his mount.
Now.
She hissed some Elan curse and kicked her Vagath into motion. Grinning, Stormy mounted up and set out.
Classic Malazan military structure at work here, woman. Short, violent discussion, and that's it. We don't wait around. And Gessler, I'm gonna bust your jaw.
Grubb watched Stormy's departure and scowled.
Something's up!
Sin snorted.
Thanks. I was just falling asleep, and now you've woke me up again. Who cares where Stormy's going?
I do.
They're mostly dead, she said, and he's going to confirm that. You want to go with him, Grubb? Want to look at Keneb's corpse? Should I go with you, so I can see what the vultures have done to my brother? The truth is in your heart, Grubb. You feel it just like I do. They're dead.
At her harsh words, Grubb hunched down, looked away. Rows of Chimal, Vagath soldiers, their massive elongated heads moving in smooth rhythm, their hides coated in dust that dulled the burnished gold of the scales on their necks and backs. Weapons slung down from harnesses of drone hide, swinging and rustling, ornate helms hiding the soldiers' eyes.
But every soldier's eyes look the same. Seen too much, and more's coming, and they know it. Uncle Keneb, it's all over for you now, finally. And you never really wanted any of it anyway, did you? Your wife left you. All you had was the army, and you died with it. Did you ever want anything else?
But he didn't know the truth of any of that. He hadn't lived enough of his own life. He tried getting into the heads of people like Keneb, the ones with so many years behind them, and he couldn't. He could recite what he knew of them.
Whirlwind, slaughter and flight, love's lost, but what do I know about that? Keneb, you're gone. I'll never see your face again. Your exasperation when you looked at me, and even then I knew you'd never abandon me. You just couldn't, and I knew it. And that is what I have lost, isn't it? I don't even have a name for it, but it's gone now, forever gone.
He glanced over at Sin. Her eyes were closed and she rolled in the Vagath's gate, chin settling on her breastbone.
Your brother has died, Sin, and you just sleep. The magic's carved everything out of you, hasn't it? You're just wearing that girl's face, her skin, and whatever you are there inside. It isn't human at all anymore, is it? And you want me to join you? Well, if it means an end to feeling pain, then I will. Keneb, why did you leave me?
Eyes closed, her mind wandered into a place of dust and sand, where the sun's fading light turned the cliffs into fire. She knew this world. She had seen it many times, had walked it. And somewhere in the hazy distances there were familiar faces, figures seething in the hot markets of Gdanisban, cool corridors and the slap of bared feet. And then terror, servants with bloodied knives, a night of smoke and flames, and all through the city screams pierced the madness. Stumbling into a room, a most precious room, was that her mother, sister? Or just some guest? The 2 stable boys and a handmaiden, who was always laughing, she recalled, and was laughing again, with her fist and most of her forearm pushed up inside Mother, while the boys held the battered woman down. Whatever the laughing girl was reaching for, she couldn't seem to find it. Blurred panic, flight, one of the boys setting off after her. Bared feet slapping on stone, the ragged beat of hard breaths. He caught her in the corridor, and in the cool shadow he used something other than his fist on her. In the same place, and by his cries, he found whatever it was he'd been looking for. A moment before, a strange barrier inside her head was torn through, and sorcery rushed out to lift the boy straight up, until he was pressed awkwardly against the arched ceiling of the corridor. His eyes were bulging, face darkening, the thing between his legs shriveling and turning black as blood vessels began bursting inside him. She'd stared up, fixing on his swollen eyes, watched them begin spraying blood in fine jets, and still she pushed. His bones cracked, fluid spurted, his waist splashing down onto her legs to mix with the blood pooling there. As he flattened, he spread out, until it seemed he was part of the stone, a ghastly image of something vaguely human, made of skin and plaster and oozing mud. By then, she suspected, he'd been dead for some time, crawling away, feeling broken inside, as if he was still there and would always be there, as if she had nothing of herself, nothing pure or untouched by someone else. Then, much later, an assassin's face, a night of caves and demons and murder. She'd been dreaming of poison, yes, and there had been bloated bodies, but nothing cleaned her out, no matter what she tried. Outside a city, watching the flames ever rising. Soldiers were dying. The world was a trap, and they all seemed surprised by that, even though it was something she'd always known. The fire wanted her, and it so wanted her, why, she let it inside, to burn her empty. She'd wanted to believe that it had worked, that she was at last clean. But before too long, she could feel that boy return deep, deep inside her. She needed more, more fire, because fire delivered death. And in the midst of conflagration, time and again, a voice whispered to her.
You are my child. The virgin of death is never what they think it is. What dies is the virgin herself, the purity of her soul, or his. Why always assume the virgin is a girl? So I show you what you were, but now I show you what you are. Feel my heat. It is the pleasure you have forever lost. Feel my kiss upon your lips. This is the love you will never know. See my hunger. It is your yearning for a peace you will never find. You are my child. You killed him before he left you. You crushed his brain to pulp. The rest was just for show. He was still inside you, a dead boy, and this was Hood's pass to your soul, and the Lord of Death's touch steals life. You killed the boy, but the boy killed you too, Sin. What do you feel deep in you? Give it any shape you want, any name, it doesn't matter. What matters is this. It is dead, and it waits for you, and will wait for you until your last breath leaves your body. When your death is already inside you, there is nowhere to run, no escape possible. When your death is already inside you, Sin, you have nothing to lose.
She had nothing to lose. This was true. About everything. No family, no brother, no one at all. Even Grub, her sweet virgin. Well, he would never reach her, just as she would never, ever reach inside him, to dirty what was pure.
My precious possession, dear Grub, and him I will keep safe from harm. No one will ever touch him, no slap of bared feet, no harsh breaths. I am your fire, Grub, and I will burn to ash anything and anyone who dares get close to you. That is why I rode the lizard's lightning, that brilliant fire. I rode it straight for Kenneb. I didn't guide it, I didn't choose it, but I understood the necessity of it, the rightness of taking away the one person left who loved you. Do not grieve. You have me, Grub. We have each other. And what could be more perfect than that?
Familiar faces in the distant haze. Her mind wandered the desert as the night drew in, and somewhere down on the flats, small fires lit awake, and she smiled.
We are the dead thing in the womb of the world, and we alone light the darkness with fire. By that you will know us. By those flames alone the earth shall tremble. What is it to be raped? I am silent as the world, and we will say nothing. What is it to be the rapist?
The desert at night was a cold place, except for the fires. Dark, too, except for the fires.
It plagues the young, this need to find reasons for things. Rudelal huddled, robes drawn tight around him, and edged closer to the fire. The wind up in these crags was fierce, the air thin and icy. Far below, low on the slopes of the mountainsides, the edge of the tree line was visible as a black mass, thinning at the highest reaches, which seemed very far away. He shivered. Couldn't we at least find a cave or something? Silchas ruins stood facing the high passes to the north, seemingly immune to the cold.
Very well. Come the morrow, we shall do that. Had we remained Elaint, of course.
I would be comfortable, yes, I know. Rude stared at the feeble flames as they devoured the last of the wood he had carried up from below. In draconic form, the raging chaos within him would have kept him warm, inured to the elements. But his thoughts twisted wild when he was veered, when the blood of the Elaint coursed dominant in his veins. He began to lose his sense of himself as a creature of reasoning, of rational thought and clear purpose. Not that he had a clear purpose, of course, not yet. But it wasn't healthy to be a dragon. He knew that much. Mother, how could you have lived with this for so long? No wonder you went mad. No wonder you all did. He glanced over at Silchas ruin, but the figure had not moved. How much longer? He wanted to ask. Still, the Tist Andi needed no further invitation to view him as little more than a child. A child of terrible power, true, but still a child. And, Rude aloud, he would not be far wrong, would he? There was no sense to what they intended to do. So much was out of their hands. They hovered like swords, but whose gauntleted grasp would close on them when the time came? There didn't seem to be an answer to that question, at least not one Silchas ruin was willing to share. And what of this Tist Andi, standing there as if carved from alabaster, rubies for eyes, moaning blades crossing his back? He had lost his last surviving brother. He was utterly alone, bereft. Olar Athiel had broken him for no purpose Rude could see, barring that of spite. But Silchas ruin had finally straightened, biting on that wound in the manner of a speared wolf, and he'd been limping ever since, at least in his assembled state. It was quite possible, and indeed likely, that Silchas ruin preferred to remain in an Elaint form, if only to cauterize the pain with the soul fire of chaos. Yet there he stood. Because I am too weak to resist. Draconian ambitions taste bitter as poison. They want my surrender. They want to hear me howl with desire.
Once we find a cave, resumed Silchas ruin, I will leave you for a time. Those stone weapons of yours are insufficient for what comes. While it is true that we may have no need for swords and the like, I believe it is time for you to take to hand a proper blade.
You want to go and find me a sword?
Yes.
And where do you look for something like that? Rude asked. A weaponsmith's in Letharas? A trader's camp near a recent battlefield?
None of those, he replied. For you, I have something more ambitious in mind.
Rude's gaze returned to the flames.
How long will you be gone?
Not long, I should think.
Well then, Rude snapped. What are you waiting for? I can find my own cave.
He felt Silchas ruin's regard upon him, and then it was gone, and when he turned, so was the Tist-Andi. He had plummeted from the ledge. Moments later, a buffet of wind struck him, and he saw the dragon lifting skyward, up above the ravaged peaks, blotting out stars. Ah, Silchas, I am sorry. Despondent, he held his hands out over the coals. He missed his father. Udinas would have a wry grin for this moment, a few cutting words, not too deep, of course, but enough to awaken in Rud a measure of self-regard, something he suspected he needed. Spirits of the stream, it's just that I'm lonely. I miss home. The sweet songs of the Imas, the fiery lure of Kilava. Oh, Omrak, do you know how lucky you are? And where is my love? Where does she hide? He glared around at the bare rock, the flight of sparks, the frail shelter in this crook of stone. Not here, that's for sure. Well, if any man needed a woman more than he did, it was his father. In a way, he is as alone among the Imas as I am here. He was a slave, a sailor, a lethary. His home was civilized, crowded with so many conveniences one could go mad trying to choose among them. And now he lives in a hut of hide and tenag bones, with winter closing in. Oh, the Imas knew a harsh world. No, none of that was fair on Udinas, who saw himself as so unexceptional he was beneath notice. Unexceptional? Will it take a woman to convince you otherwise? You can't find one there. You need to go home, father. He could try ascending, a conjuration of will and power. Was it possible to reach that far? Worth a try, he muttered. Tomorrow morning. For now, Rudelal would try to sleep. If that failed, well, there was the blood of the Elaint and its deadly, sultry call. He lifted his head, looked south. At the far side of the range, he knew, there was a vast green valley, slopes ribboned with terraces, verdant with growth. There were towns and villages and forts and high towers guarding the bridges spanning the rivers. There were tens of thousands working those narrow fields. They had flown so high above all of this, to a human eye they would have been virtually invisible. When they drew nearer to the rearing range north of the valley, close to its westernmost end, they had seen an encamped army laying siege to a fastness carved into the first of the mountains. Rud had wondered at that. Civil war? But Silchas Ruin had shown no curiosity.
Humans can do whatever they please, and they will. Count on it, Riad.
Still, he imagined it was warm inside that keep right now, assuming it still held against the enemy. For some reason, he was sure that it did.
Aye, humans will do whatever they please, Silchas Ruin, and they'll be damned stubborn about it, too.
He settled down against the cold night. His thoughts were earth, and the blood moved slowly through it, seeping like a summer's rain. He saw how the others looked at him, when they'd thought his attention elsewhere. So much larger than any of them was he, bedecked in the armor of Dalk's hide, his Athelian mace showing a face to each of the cardinal directions, as befitted the witch's gift from the sky. Listening to them readying their weapons, adjusting the straps of their armor, locking the grilled cheek guards in place on their blackened helms, he knew that in the past weeks he had become the mountain they huddled against. The stone at their backs, on their flanks, at the point of the spear, wherever he was needed most, there he would be. How many of the foe had he killed? He had no idea. Scores, hundreds. They were the fangs of death. Their numbers were endless, and that, he well knew, was no exaggeration. His fellow invaders, who once numbered in their tens of thousands, had dwindled now. It might be that other fragments still pushed on, somewhere to the south or north, but then they did not have a Thel Akai warrior in their company. They did not have a dragon killer.
They do not have me.
Earth was slow in dying. The soil was a black realm of countless mouths, ceaseless hungers. In a single handful raged a million wars. Death was ever the enemy, yet death was also the source of sustenance. It took a ferocious will to murder Earth. One by one, his companions, barely a score left now, announced themselves ready in rising to their feet, in testing their gauntleted grips on their notched, battered weapons. And such weapons, each one worth a dozen epic songs of glory and pain, triumph and loss. If he looked up from the ground at this moment, he would see faces swallowed in the barred shadows of their cheek guards. He would see these proud warriors standing, eyes fixed eastward, and slowly those grimly set mouths and the thin, tattered lips would twist with wry amusement. A war they could not win. An epic march from which not one great hero would ever return. The earth within him surged with sudden fire, and he rose, the mace lifting in his huge hands.
We shall have lived as none other has lived. We shall die as no other has died. Can you taste this moment? By the witch, but I can.
He faced his companions and gave them his own grin. Tusked mouths opened like split flesh, and cold laughter filled the air. Groaning, Ublala Pung opened his eyes. More dreams, more terrible visions. He rolled onto his side and blinked across the makeshift camp at the huddled form of the Barghast woman. His love, his adored one. It wasn't fair that she hated him. He reached out and drew close the strange mace with its four blue iron heads. It looked as if it should be heavy, and perhaps to some people it was. And it had a name. Its very own name, but he'd forgotten it.
A dozen and four epic songs. Songs of glory and painty, turnips and lust.
Perhaps she was just pretending to sleep, and she'd try to kill him again. The last time Draconis had stopped her, appearing as if out of nowhere to grasp her wrist, staying the dagger's point a finger's breadth from Ublala's right eye. He'd then slapped the woman hard enough to send her sprawling.
Best we kill her now, Ublala.
Rubbing the sleep from his face.
No, please don't do that. I love her. It's just a spat of some sort, Draconis. And as soon as I figure out what we're arguing about, I'll fix it, I swear. Ublala, please, we're just disagreeing about something. She means to kill and then rob us. She had cruel parents and was bullied as a child, Draconis. Other girls pulled her braids and spat in her ears. It's all a misunderstanding. One more chance, then. My advice is to beat her senseless, Ublala. It's likely that's how Barghast men treat murderous women, as necessity demands.
I can't do that, Draconis, but I'll comb her hair.
Which was what he had been doing when she'd finally come round. Lacking a comb, he'd been using a thorny twig, which probably wasn't ideal, especially on her fine eyebrows, but they'd since taken care of the infections, and she was looking almost normal again. So maybe she really was asleep. And now that she had no weapons left, why, she was as harmless as a twill mouse, except for the big rocks she kept close at hand every night. At least she had stopped complaining. Ublala twisted to see if he could find Draconis. The man never seemed to sleep at all, though he'd lie down on occasion, which is what he'd been doing when Relata had tried knifing Ublala. Wasn't she surprised? The man was standing facing north, something he had been doing a lot of lately. People like him had too many thoughts, Ublala decided. So many he couldn't even rest from himself, and that had to be a hard thing to live with. No, it was better to have hardly any thoughts at all.
Like Earth. Yes, that's it all right. Dirt. But those tusks were scary, and that laughing was even worse.
A new scent on the cool breath drifting in from the west. Perhaps some ancient memories were stirred by it, something that left the pack agitated. She watched the lord stretching and then padding up to the rise. He possessed such power, as did all lords. He could stand on a high place exposed to all four winds and feel no fear. The others remained in the high grasses of the slope, the young males pacing, the females in the shadow of the trees, where pups crawled and tumbled. Bellies were full, but the herds wending up from the plains to the south were smaller this season, and there was a harried air to their long flight from thirst and heat, as if pursued by fire or worse. Hunting the beasts had been easy. The animal they'd brought down had already been exhausted, and the taste of old terror was in its blood. The lord stood on the ridge. His ears sharpened, and the others quickly rose. Even the games of the pups ceased. The lord staggered. Three sticks were jutting from it now, and from the slope beyond came strange excited barks. Blood threaded down from the sticks as the lord sank down, head twisting in a vain effort to reach the shafts. Then it fell on its side and stopped moving. There was motion on all sides now, and more sticks whipped through foliage and grasses, sinking into flesh. The pack erupted in snarls of pain. The figures that rushed in moved on their hind legs. Their skins gleamed with oil, and their smell was that of crushed plants over something else. They flung more sticks. There was white around their eyes, and they had small mouths from which came their wild barking. She gasped as fire tore into her flank. Blood filled her throat, sprayed out from her nostrils, and then poured from her jaws. She saw an attacker reach down and grasp a pup by its tail. He swung it and then slammed the little one against the bole of a tree. An old scent.
They are among us again. There is nowhere to hide. Now we die.
Vision blurred. Setok withdrew her hand from the bleached wolf's skull they'd found in the crotch of the gnarled tree growing from the edge of the dried-up spring. The rough, tortured bark had almost devoured the bleached bone. The first tree they'd found in weeks, she wiped at her eyes.
And this.
It wasn't enough to grieve. She saw that now. Not enough to wallow in the anguish of blood on the hands. It wasn't enough to fight for mercy, to plead for a new way of walking the world. It wasn't enough to feel guilt. She turned to study the camp. Faint, precious thimble, sweetest sufferance and ambi bowl, all looking for a way home. A place of comfort, all threats diminished, all dangers locked away. Where patrols kept the streets safe, where the fields ran in rows and so did trees, or so she imagined. Strange scenes that couldn't be memory, because she had no memory beyond the plains and the wild lands. But in those cities the only animals nearby were slaves or food, and those that weren't lived in cages, or their skins adorned the shoulders of fine ladies and bold nobles, or their bones waited in heaps for the grinders to be fed into the planted fields. That was their world, the one they wanted back.
You can have it. There is no place for me in it, is there? Very well.
The sorrow within her now seemed infinite. She walked from the camp out into the darkness. The bonecaster had taken the children and Torrent with them. Destinies had taken the Trell and Gruntle. Death had taken the others.
But I owe you nothing. In your company, my ghost wolves stay away. They drift like distant desires. I am forgetting what it is to run free. I am forgetting why I am here.
They would not miss her. They had their own haunts after all.
I do not belong with you. I think I am what you left behind long ago.
She wondered if she too was in search of a destiny, the same as Mappo and Gruntle. But it seemed they were so much more than her, and that even the idea of a destiny for Setok was ridiculous.
But the ghost wolves and all the other fallen beasts, they look to me for something. I just don't know what it is, and I need to find out.
Is that what destiny is? Is that all it is? It was surprisingly easy to leave them behind, the ones she'd walked with for so long now. She could have turned back right then to face the city, all the cities and all the broken lands that fed them. She could have chosen to accept her humanness. Instead,
look at me. Here I walk. Let the wolves cleanse this world. Let the beasts return. Above all, let the senseless killing end. We are tired of running, tired of dying. You must see that. You must feel something for that. Just how cold is your soul? You empty the land. You break the earth and use it until it dies, and then your children starve. Do not blame me. Do not blame any of us for that.
Her breath caught, and she hesitated. A sudden dark thought had flared in her mind, a knife in her hand, throats opening to the night. Four more of the murderers dead, in a war that she knew might never end.
But what difference does that make? We've been losing for so long, I doubt we'd know the taste of victory even as it filled our mouths, even as it drowned us in its glory.
Could she kill them? Could she turn around, here and now, and creep back into the camp?
No pop skulls to crack open, but still, the dead inside have to work hard at their pleasures. That burst of shock, disbelief, the sudden laugh. So hard to feel anything at all, isn't it?
The thoughts were delicious, but she resumed her journey. It was not, she decided, her destiny to kill one here, another there. No, if she could, she would kill them all.
This is the war the wolves have sought. The hold shall be reborn. Am I to be their leader? Am I to stand alone at the head of some vast army of retribution?
All at once, the ghost wolves were surrounding her, brushing close, and she began a loping run, effortlessly, her heart surging with strength. Freedom, she understood now, was something so long lost among humans that they had forgotten what it felt like.
Bend to your labors, grasp those coins. Keep the doors locked and fires raging to empty the shadows behind you. Make your brothers and sisters kneel before you to serve your pleasures. Are you free? You don't remember the truth of what once was, of what you all so willingly surrendered. I will show you freedom. So I vow. I will show you what it is to be free.
On all sides, the ghost wolves howled.
She's gone.
Faint opened her eyes, blinked at the bright morning sun.
What? Who? The girl, Setok, with the wolf eyes, gone.
She stared up at Ambi, frowning, and then said,
Oh, I don't think she's coming back.
No, Ambi, I don't either.
He moved back as she sat up. Her chest ached, her ragged scars itched. She was filthy, and the taste in her mouth was thick with the rancid meat they'd eaten the night before. Ambi stood like a man lost in the company of anyone but his brother. Just a glance nearly broke her heart. She looked past him. Sweetest Sufferance was still asleep, her rounded form swathed in blankets. Precious Thimble sat near the ashes of the night's fire, eyes fixed dully on Ambi. She'd heard tales of horror amongst the shareholders who'd signed out and now sat in taverns waiting to die. They'd drink and tell of missions that had ended in disaster. A dead mage lost in unknown lands, no way home. A few lucky ones would find a place to book passage, or perhaps another Tregal carriage would find them, half starved and half mad, and these ones would come home broken, their eyes empty. She stared up at the morning sky. Was the flying lizard still up there? Did it mock them with its cold eyes? She doubted it.
If we make it out of this, it will be a miracle. The longest tug of the lady's luck this world has ever seen. And let's face it, things don't work out that way.
They never do.
I smelled smoke, said Ambi.
When?
He shrugged.
Dawn. The wind had yet to turn. Was running before the sun.
East. She stood, studied the rumpled wastes. Was that a faint haze? No, that veil was too big. A cloud.
Well, she said, it's where we were headed, more or less.
If the man wanted to smell things, fine, made no difference.
We need water, Ambi said.
Sighing, Faint turned and approached Precious Thimble. The young witch would not meet her eyes. Faint waited for a moment and then said,
Can you conjure water?
I told you.
Yes, the land's mostly dead. Still, can you?
There's no point in trying.
Try anyway.
Her eyes flashed.
Who left you in charge?
You're a shareholder in the Tregal. I have seniority here, Precious.
But I'm...
So far, Faint cut in, you're nothing. Show us some majory and that might drag you up a notch or two. Open us a gate home and I'll personally crown you Empress. But until then, Precious, I'm in charge.
It hurts.
What does?
Listen, people die. But she shook her head.
Magic. Here, the ground flinches.
Precious, I don't care if it howls. Just get us some water.
It doesn't want us here. It doesn't want anyone here.
Too bad.
Precious shivered.
There's something... If it's a spirit, even the ghost of one, maybe...
Get started on it.
Faint walked over to Sweetest Sufferance.
Hood's breath, wake up.
I'm awake, cow.
Well... Turned out everyone felt as miserable as she did.
Hungry,
said Precious Thimble.
Gods below.
Faint looked to the east again. Cloud or smoke? Nearby, Ambi made a groaning sound. She glanced over. Something was wrong with his face. Mud streaks? Tears? No, too dark. She stepped closer.
What? Is that blood?
Nearby, the pack horse tore free of the stake tethering it and lunged away, hoofs thundering. A rattling sound erupted from Sweetest Sufferance. Faint spun.
Sweetie?
The blanket-swathed form was twitching.
Hungry,
said Precious Thimble again. Spasms surged through Sweetest Sufferance, her limbs jumping. She kicked her way clear of the blankets, rolled onto her back. Her eyes were opened wide, filling with blood. Her face was visibly swelling, flesh split.
In here?
Asked Precious Thimble. Faint whirled to the witch, saw the strange tilt to her head, the drool slicking her chin. Her eyes were glazed. She rushed over.
Get it out! Precious, send it away!
Sweetest Sufferance jerked upright, blood draining down from her fingertips. Bony projections had pushed through her face, closing the space for her eyes, her mouth. Her entire body shook as if something was inside, trying to escape. Tearing sounds burst from under her clothing as more bones thrust past skin, pushed at her sodden clothing. The ground beneath the woman seemed to be cracking open. Numb with horror, Faint backed up a step. Shock stole her will.
Precious, please!
Ambi suddenly howled, and the cry was so raw it jolted Faint awake. Twisting round once more, she rushed to Precious Thimble. Struck the woman in the face, a vicious slap, as hard as she could manage. The young witch's head rocked. Ambi screamed again. Faint glanced back at Sweetest Sufferance, but the woman was mostly gone, and in her place, rising up from the broken earth below, was a stained wrist thick as the bole of an ancient tree. The hand had pushed its fingers through the woman's body as if fighting free of an ill-fitting glove. Gore-streaked nails clawed at the air. The ground tilted beneath Faint, almost pitching her from her feet. Ambi staggered up to Precious Thimble, his face a mask of blood, and when his fist struck her face, her entire head snapped back. She toppled. Bawling, he took her in his arms and began running. The arm was reaching higher, the remnants of Sweetest Sufferance's body still clinging to the grasping hand. Blood was burning away, blackening, shedding in flakes, revealing a limb of purest jade. Faint staggered back. A mound was rising, an entire hill, splitting the hard ground. The tree at the spring thrashed, and on its long dead branches green suddenly sprouted, writhing like worms. Jade fruit bulged, burgeoned in clusters to pull the branches down. Rock exploded from a ridge 50 paces to the south. High grasses waved like jade flames. A vast gleaming boulder rocked into view.
A forehead. Oh, gods below. Oh, Hood. Beru, please.
Draconis turned round, his eyes black as pools of ink.
Wait here, he said.
Ublala opened his mouth, but the ground was shaking, rolling like waves rushing in from somewhere to the north, and he forgot what he wanted to ask. He turned to his beloved. Relata was awake, crouched low on the balls of her feet. Terror filled her face as she stared past Ublala. He turned back in time to see Draconis drawing his sword. Blackness poured from the long blade like wind-whipped shrouds, billowing out, twisting to close around the man like folding wings. Draconis disappeared inside the darkness, and the inky clouds spiraled higher, growing in size. In moments it towered over them, and then those black wings unfolded once more. The apparition rose into the sky, enormous wings of inky smoke thundering the air. Ublala stared after it. His mace was in his hands for some reason, and the skystone head steamed as if dipped in a forge. He watched the huge thing fly away, northward. Not a dragon. Winged darkness.
Just that. Winged darkness.
He licked his lips.
Draconis?
The brow ridges lifted clear of the shattered bedrock. Eyes blazed like emerald beacons. A second hand had thrust free, 30 paces to the west. Faint stood as if rooted to the shaking ground, as trapped as the rattling tree. Her thoughts had fled. A pressure was building inside her skull. She could hear voices, thousands, tens of thousands of voices, all speaking in a language she could not understand. They were rising in alarm, in fear, in panic. She clapped her hands to her ears, but it was no use.
They want out. They asked, but no answers came. They begged, pleaded. The world gave them silence. How do I know this? Their hearts, the beating, I can feel them breaking.
Anguish tore at her soul. She could not survive this. It was too much, the pain too vast. Icy air swept over her from behind. An enormous shadow swirled across the earth to her left. Something enshrouded in darkness, borne on vast ethereal wings, descended to where the jade head was emerging. Faint saw the flash of something long and black, a gleaming edge. And as the darkness slammed like a tidal wave against the brow of the giant, that splinter was driven forward, piercing the center of the forehead. Thunder cracked. Faint was thrown from her feet by the concussion. The impossible chorus of voices cried out, in pain, in shock, and something else. Beneath her, the earth seemed to moan. Staggering upright once more, Faint coughed out the blood filling her mouth.
Those cries! Relief? At last an answer.
The forearm directly in front of her and the hand off to the west were suddenly motionless, the jade luminescence fading as if sheathed in dust. The tree, tilted precariously to one side, slowed its manic shivering, its branches now burdened with leaves of jade and the huge globes of fruit. Up on the hill, the darkness coalesced, like a slowly indrawn breath, and in its place stood a tall, broad-shouldered man. His hands were clasped about the grip of a two-handed sword, bleeding black streams that spun lazily in the air. She saw him struggle to pull the weapon from the jade forehead that reared like a stone wall in front of him. He grunted when he finally succeeded. The sword slid into the scabbard slung under his left arm. He turned round, walked towards Faint. Pale skin, chiseled features, black hair, depthless eyes. As he neared her, he spoke in Daru.
Where he came from, every god is a shield anvil. Woman, have you lost your mind?
She opened her mouth for a denial, a rush of protest, but then he was walking past her. She turned, stared after him.
South? What's down there? Where are you going?
No, never mind, faint.
Gods below, what have I just witnessed?
Her gaze returned to the sundered forehead surmounting the hill. The wound in its center was visible even from this distance. It had nearly split the giant's skull in half. She slowly sank to her knees.
A god. That was a god. Were they both gods? Did one just murder the other?
She realized that she had wet herself. One more reek to clash with all the others. Drawing a shaky breath, she lowered her head.
Sweetest sufferance, I'm sorry. She warned me against it. I'm sorry, sweetie. Please forgive me.
She would, in a while, set out to find Ambi and Precious Thimble, but not yet.
Not quite yet.
Ublala watched her tying up her bedroll.
Where are you going? We should wait. He said to wait.
She bared her teeth, but did not look at him.
He is a demon. When he runs out of things to hunt, he'll kill and eat us.
No, he won't. He's nice. Draconis is nice, my love.
Don't call me that.
But...
Be quiet. Give me back my knife.
I can't. You might stab me.
I won't. I'm leaving you both. I'm going home.
Home? Where is that? Can I come?
Only if you can swim, she said. Now, at least the knife. And if you love me the way you say you do, you'll give me the rest of my weapons, too.
I'm not supposed to.
Venom blazed in her eyes.
You're awake. You're holding that club. I can't hurt you unless you're a coward, Ublala. I can't love cowards. They disgust me.
He hunched down.
Just because I'm scared of you don't mean I'm a coward. I once fought 5 Teblor gods.
Of course you did. Cowards always lie.
And I fought against the fangs of death and all those tusked warriors liked me. No, that wasn't me. At least, I don't think it was.
He stared at the mace.
But I killed Dalk. I killed a dragon. It was easy. No, it wasn't. It was hard, I think. I can't remember.
No end to all the lies.
You're right, he said, suddenly glum. No end to them.
Give me my weapons.
If I do, you'll die.
What?
You'll leave us, and there's no food out here unless Draconis gets it for us. You'll starve. I can't.
Am I your prisoner? Is that how you like it, Ublala? You want a slave?
He looked up at her.
Can I sex you any time if you're my slave?
That's not love, she said.
It's been so long, he replied. I suppose I'll take sex instead of love. See what's happened to me?
Fine. I'll lie with you if you give me my weapons afterwards.
Ublala clutched his head.
Oh, you're confusing me!
She advanced on him.
Agree to my offer, Ublala, and I'm yours.
She stopped abruptly, turned away. He stared after her.
What's wrong? I agree! I agree!
Too late, she said. Your friend's back.
Ublala twisted round to see Draconis approaching.
He's no friend of mine, he muttered. Not any more.
Too crowded, these wastelands, she said.
Then leave us, Torrent replied. We won't miss you.
In answer, Olar Ithil picked up Absi once more by the scruff of his neck.
We have rested enough, she said.
Stop carrying him like that, said Torrent. He can ride with me.
Her neck creaked as she turned to regard him.
Attempt to flee, and I will catch you, pup.
Torrent glanced across at the twins, who huddled together near the ring of stones where they had tried making a fire the night before.
I won't do that, he said.
Sentimentality will see the death of you, said the bonecaster. Come here, take the child.
He strode over. When he reached for the boy, Olarethil's skeletal hand snapped out. Torrent was dragged close, pulled up until his eyes were less than a hand's breadth from her broken face.
Call upon no gods in this place, she hissed. Everything's too close to the surface. Do you understand me? Even the ghost of Tok Younger cannot withstand a summons, and he will not arrive alone.
She pushed him back.
You have been warned, my only warning. I catch you whispering a prayer, Torrent of the All, and I will kill you.
He stepped back, scowling.
That threat's getting as old as you, hag.
He took Abs's hand and led him slowly to where his horse waited.
And we need food. Remember what that is, Olarethil, and water.
He looked round, but could see no sign of Telerast and Curdle. When had he last seen them? He could not recall. Sighing, he beckoned to the twins. Starvi and Story leapt to their feet and joined him.
Can you walk for a time? He asked them. Later you can ride, a little longer than you did yesterday. I don't mind walking.
Did you hear that thunder?
Starvi asked.
Just thunder.
Is our father still alive?
Story asked.
Is he really?
I won't lie, Torrent said. If his spirit walks the land again, he is the same as Olarethil at T'lani Mas. I fear there will be little that you will recognize.
Except what's inside him, said Story. That won't have changed.
Torrent glanced away.
I hope you're right, for all our sakes.
He hesitated and then said,
After all, if anyone can stand up to this bonecaster, it will be your father.
He'll take us back, said Starvi. All three of us, you'll see.
He nodded.
Ready, then?
No, he wouldn't lie to them, not about their father. But some suspicions he would keep to himself. He did not expect Olarethil to take them to Onos Tulan. Absi, and perhaps even the twins, had become her currency when forcing the first sword's hand, and she would not permit a situation where he could directly challenge her over possession of them. No, these coins of flesh she would keep well hidden. Torrent collected up Absi, his heart clenching as the boy's arms went round his neck. The young were quick to adapt, he knew, but even then there were hurts that slipped through awareness, leaving not a ripple, and they sank deep. And many years later, why, they'd shaped an entire life.
Abandon the child, and all the man's tethers will be weak. Take away the child's love, and the woman will be a leaf on every stream. So the older ones said, always full of warnings, telling us all that life was a treacherous journey, that a path once begun could not easily be evaded or twisted anew by wish or will.
With a grinning Absi settled on the saddle, his small hands gripping the horn, Torrent collected the reins. The twins falling in beside him, he set off after Olarethil. The thunder had stopped as quickly as it had begun, and the cloudless sky was unchanged. Terrible forces were in play in these wastelands, enough to shake even the deathless witch striding so purposefully ahead of them.
Call upon no gods in this place.
A curious warning. Had someone prayed? He snorted.
When did praying achieve anything but silence? Anything but the pathetic absence filling the air, building like a bubble of nothingness in the soul? Since when didn't a prayer leave only empty yearning, where wishes burned and longing was a knife twisting in the chest? Call upon no gods in this place. Summon not Tok Annister, my one-eyed guardian who can ride through the veil, who can speak with the voice of death itself. Why do you so fear him, Olarethil? What can he do to you? But I know the answer to that, don't I?
Ahead, the bonecaster hesitated, turning to stare at Torrent. When he smiled, she faced forward again and resumed her walk.
Yes, Olarethiel, these wastelands are very crowded indeed. Step lightly, hag, as if that will do any good.
Absey made a strange grunting sound and then sang,
Ta-la-la-la-la-la-la, ta-la-la-la-la-la.
Every word from a child is itself a prayer, a blessing. Dare we answer? Beware, little Absey, Olarethiel. There are hurts that slip through. You killed his dog. You killed his dog.
The fabric between the warrens was shredded. Gaping holes yawned on all sides. As befitted his veered form, Gruntle moved in the shadows, a creature of stealth, muscles rolling beneath his barbed hide, eyes flaring like embers in the night. But purchase under his padded paws was uncertain. Vistas shifted wildly before his fixed gaze. Only desperation and perhaps madness had taken him on these paths. One moment flowing down a bitter, cold scree of moss-backed boulders, the next moving like a ghost through a cathedral forest cloaked in fetid gloom. In yet another, the air was foul with poisons, and he found himself forced to swim a river, the waters thick and crusted with brown foam. Up onto the bank and into a village of cut stone, crowded with carriages, passing through a graveyard, a fox pitching an eerie cry upon catching his scent. He stumbled upon two figures, their sudden appearance so startling him that alarm unleashed his instincts. A snarl, sudden rush, claws and then fangs. Screams tore the night air. His jaws crunched down through the bones of a human neck. A lash of one clawed paw ripped one side from a dog, flinging the dying beast into the brush. And then through, away from that world, and into a sodden jungle lit by flashes of lightning, the reek of sulphur heavy in the air. Down a bank of mud, into a charnel pit of rotting corpses, the bloated bodies of men and horses, someone singing plaintively in the distance. A burning forest. The corridor of a palace or temple, dozens of robed people fleeing with shrieks, and once more he tore through them, human blood filling his mouth, the taste appallingly sweet. Dragging bodies down from behind, crunching through skulls, weak fists thumping into his flanks. Somewhere deep inside him, he loosed a sob, tearing himself free, and once more the world shifted, a barren tundra now. Someone kneeling beside a boulder, head lifting, eyes meeting his.
Stop this, now! Child of Treach, you lose yourself to the beast's blood.
A woman, her long black hair thick and glossy as a panther's hide, her face broad, the cheekbones high and flaring, her amber eyes filled with knowing. A few rags of caribou skin for clothes, despite the frigid air.
When you find me, she continued, it will not be as you imagine. We shall not meet as lovers. We shall not desire the same things. It may be we shall fight, you and me.
He crouched, sides heaving, muscles trembling, but the blind rage was fading. She made an odd gesture with one hand.
A cat leaps, takes the life of a bird. Another takes the life of a child playing in the garden. This is what a cat does. Do you deny this? Is there a crime in these scenes? Perhaps. For the bird, the crime of carelessness, incaution. A child? An inattentive parent? An ill-chosen place to dwell in? The chicks in their nest cry out for a mother who will not return. Her death is their deaths. The mother grieves her loss, but perhaps there will be another child, a new life to replace the one lost. Tell me, Gruntle, how does one measure these things? How does one decide which life is the more precious? Are feelings apportioned according to intelligence and self-awareness? Does a tiny creature grieve less deeply than one of greater stature?
But is it not natural to rage for vengeance, for retribution? Does the dead bird's mate dream of murder? Child of Treach, you have taken more than just children on this hard path of yours. In your wake, much grief now swirls. Your arrival was inexplicable to their senses, but the proof of your presence lay in pools of blood. Be the weapon of random chance if you must. Be the unimaginable force that strikes down with no reason, no purpose. Be the taker of lives. I will await you at the end of this path. Will we discuss vengeance with fang and claw? At the threat, a low growl rumbled from his chest. Her smile was sad. She gestured again. Blinking, Gruntle found himself on his hands and knees, stony ground under him. He coughed and then spat to clear gobs of thick blood from his mouth, reached up and wiped his wet lips. On the back of his hand, a red smear and strands of human hair.
"Gods below,"
he muttered.
"That was a mistake."
The warrens were falling apart.
Where was I going? What was I running from?
But he remembered. Betrayals, weaknesses, the flaws of being human. He'd sought an escape. A headlong plunge into mindlessness, fleeing from all manner of remorse and recrimination.
Running away. But what is the point?
He said under his breath.
To forget is to forget myself, who I am, and that I must not surrender. If I do, I will have nothing left. Ah, but still, to be blameless, a cat above the tiny carcass of a bird, above the corpse of a child. Blameless. But the bastards hunting me down don't care about that. A child has died. Mothers bow in wretched grief. Weapons are taken in hand. The world is a dangerous place. They mean to make it less so. They yearn to die ancient and withered in straw beds at the end of a long life, with skins upon their walls proclaiming their bravery. Well then, come to me if you must. To your eyes I am a monstrous tiger. But in my mind, I have a man's cunning. And yes, I know all about vengeance.
He could see now where his path was taking him. Trake's deadly gift was turning in his hands, finding a new, terrible shape.
You would set yourselves apart, then? Not animal, something other. Very well, then there will be war.
Brushing at his eyes, he climbed slowly to his feet.
Admire the beast. He is brave, even as he charges your spear. And should you then stand above my corpse, note well your own bravery. But in my lifeless eyes, see this truth. What we have shared in this clash of courage, friend, was not a thing of sentience or intelligence. Skill and luck may be triumphant, but these are nature's gifts. Confuse this at your peril. Treach, hear me. I will fight this war. I see its inevitability. I will charge the spear, because I have no choice.
He bared his teeth.
Just make my death worthwhile.
Somewhere ahead, she awaited him. He still did not know what that meant. The veil between human and beast was shredded, and he found himself looking out from both sides, desperation and madness.
Oh, Stonny, I cannot keep my promise. I am sorry. If I could but set my eyes upon your face one more time.
He sighed.
Yes, woman. To answer your cruel question, the bird's mate dreams of murder.
The tears kept returning. blurring his vision, streaming down his scarred, pitted cheeks. But Mappo forced himself onward, fighting each step he took. Two wills were locked in battle, the need to find his friend, the need to flee his shame. The war was now a thing of pain. There had been a time, so long ago now, when he had not shied from self-regard, when, for all the deceits guiding his life, he had understood the necessity, the sharp clarity of his purpose. He stood between the world and Icarium. Why? Because the world was worth saving. Because there was love and moments of peace. Because compassion existed like a blossom in a crack of stone, a fulsome truth, a breathtaking miracle. And Icarium was a weapon of destruction, senseless, blind. Mappo had given his life to keeping that weapon in its scabbard, peace-strapped, forgotten. In the name of compassion and love. Which he had just walked away from, turning his back upon children so as to not see the hurt in their eyes, that hardening flatness as yet another betrayal beset their brief lives. Because, he told himself, their future was uncertain, yet still alive with possibilities.
But if Icarium should awaken, and no one is there to stop him, those possibilities will come to an end. Does this not make sense?
Oh yes, indeed it made sense.
And still it was wrong. I know it. I feel it. I can't hide from it. If I harden myself to compassion, then what am I trying to save?
And so he wept for himself. In the face of shame, grief burned away. In the face of shame, he began to lose who he was, who he had always believed himself to be. Duty, pride in his vow, his sacrifice, it all crumbled. He tried to imagine finding Icarium, his oldest friend. He tried to envision a return to the old ways, to his words of deception in the name of love, to the gentle games of feint and sleight of hand that they played to keep horrifying truths at bay. Everything as it once was, and at the core of it all, Mappo's willingness to surrender his own life rather than see the life-stealer's eyes catch flame. He did not know if he could do that anymore. A man's heart must be pure for such a thing, cleansed of all doubts, sufficient to make death itself a worthy sacrifice. But the solid beliefs of years past had now broken down. He felt hunched down inside himself, as if folding round an old wound, leaving his bones feeling frail, a cage that could crumple at the first hint of pressure. The wasted land passed him by on all sides, barely observed. The day's heat faltered before the conflagration in his skull. Mappo forced himself onward. He had to find Icarium now, more than ever.
To beg forgiveness and to end it. My friend, I am not enough anymore. I am not the warrior you once knew. I am not the wall to lean your weary self against. I have betrayed children, Icarium. Look into my eyes and see the truth of this. I beg a release. End it, Icarium. Please end this.
Stormy thought he could make out a pall of dust to the southeast. No telling how far. The horizons played tricks in this place. The lizard he rode devoured leagues. It never seemed to tire. Glancing back, he glowered at the drones plodding in his wake. Kel hunters ranged on his flanks, sometimes visible but mostly not, lost somewhere in the deceptive folds and creases of the landscape.
I'm riding a damned Vegath, the nastiest weapon of war I've ever seen. I don't need a damned escort.
All right, so it needed to be fed come evening. There was that to consider.
But I'm a man. I hate the need to consider anything. It's not a problem either, mostly.
He preferred being just a corporal. This shield anvil business left a sour taste in his mouth.
Aye, there's a sentimental streak in me. I don't deny it. And maybe it's wide as an ocean, like Guest says. But I didn't ask for it. I cried for a dying mouse once.
dying because I tried to catch it, only my hand was too clumsy and something got broken inside. Lying there in my palm, breaths coming so fast, but the tiny limbs had stopped moving, and then the breath slowed. I knelt on the stones and watched it slowly die, there in my hand. Gods, it's enough to make me bawl all over again, just remembering. How old was I? 20? He leaned to one side and cleared his nose, one nostril and then the other. Then cleaned his moustache with his fingers, wiping them on his leg. Dust cloud any closer? Hard to say. Clearing a rise, he cursed and silently ordered his mount to a halt. The basin below stretched out 300 or more paces, and half that distance out, a dozen or so figures were standing or sitting in a rough circle. As soon as he came into view, the ones standing turned to face him, while the ones sitting slowly climbed upright and did the same. They were tall, gaunt, and armoured in black chain, black scales, and black leather. The Kell hunters had appeared suddenly to storm his right and left, and were closing up at a swift lope, their massive cutlasses held out to the sides. Stormy could taste something oily and bitter.
"Calm down, lizards," he said under his breath, kicking the Vergath into motion. "They ain't drawing."
Dark, narrow faces beneath ornate helms tracked Stormy's approach. Withered faces.
"Those bastards are tusked. Jagged? Must be. That old bust of Gothos in Aran's great temple had tusks like those. But then, these fellows ain't looking too good. Tlan? Did the Jagged have Tlan? Oh, never mind these questions, idiot. Just ask 'em. Or not."
10 paces between them, Stormy reined in. The hunters halted a few paces back, settled and planted the tips of their cutlasses in the hard earth. He studied the warriors before him.
"Ugly," he muttered.
One spoke, though Stormy wasn't immediately certain from which one the voice came.
"Do you see this, Balerion?"
"I see," another answered.
"A human. Well, mostly human. Hard to tell behind all that hair. But let us be generous. A human with Kachain as pets. And only a few moments ago, Balerion, you had the nerve to suggest that the world was a better place than when we'd last left it."
"I did," Balerion admitted, and then added, "I was an idiot."
Low laughter. A third Jaghut then said,
"Kachain and termites, Gedoran. Find one. And you know there's 100,000 more in the woodwork. As you say, Varandas."
"And with that other smell?"
"Just so," Gedoran said,
and Stormy found him by the nod accompanying the words.
"Dust. Dreams and nightmares, Gedoran, hide in the same pit. Reach down and you're blind to what you pull out."
They were all speaking Falari, which was ridiculous. Stormy snorted and then said,
"Listen, you're in my way."
Gedoran stepped forward.
"You did not come in search of us."
"Do I really look that stupid?"
"No."
"Why, should I have?"
"He is impertinent."
"Darift, a human riding of the Gath can be as impertinent as he likes," said Balerion.
Hard laughter, heads rocking back. Stormy said,
"You're in the middle of nowhere. What are you up to?"
"Ah," said Gedoran. "Now that is a pertinent query. We have sent our commander on a quest, and now await his return."
"You order your commander around?"
"Yes, isn't that wonderful?"
The Jaghut laughed again. A habit, Stormy decided as it went on and on, that could prove maddening.
"Well, I'll leave you to it then."
The 14 Jaghut bowed, and Gedoran said,
"Until we meet again, Shield Anvil."
"I don't intend to ride back the way I came in." "Wisdom is not yet dead," said Balerion. "Did I not suggest this to you all?"
Amidst a host of idiotic assertions, perhaps you did.
Verandas, there must be a balance in the world. On one side, a morsel of weighty wisdom offsetting a gastric avalanche of brainless stupidity. Is that not the way of things?
But Beleriand, a drop of perfume cannot defeat a heap of shit.
That depends, Verandas, on where you put your nose.
Cadoran said,
Be sure to inform us, Verandas, when you finally smell something sweet.
Don't hold your breath, Cadoran.
To Rorka's laughter, Stormy kicked the Vergath into motion, steering the creature to the left to ride round the jagged. Once past, he urged his mount into a loping trot. A short while later, the Kell hunters drew in closer. He could smell their unease.
Aye,
he muttered. He wondered who the commander was.
Must be a damned idiot. But then, anything to escape that laughing. Aye, now that makes sense. Why, I'd probably ride straight up Hood's arsehole to get away from that lot. And as soon as I smell something sweet, boys and girls, why, I'll ride straight back and tell you.
That dust cloud looked closer. Maybe.